The following is a part of the Radio Memphis On Demand service. It originally aired live on Radio Memphis and has been edited for time.
There you have it. Jonathan Mover with his band Einstein right here on Radio Memphis. You're tuned into Memphis Metal Mondays with me, Dirty D, and my guest host, Phil Berger. How you doing, brother?
Good.
Man, I am so excited, you know, about this particular person that we're getting ready to have a chat with. Those of you who are tuned into Memphis Metal Mondays, we're getting ready to sit down and talk with Mr. Jonathan Mover. Now, this is a person, look, I had to get Wikipedia out just to get it all right because he's done way too much stuff.
Yeah.
Man, this is a person, Grammy Award-winning American drummer. He's worked with a number of artists. He's worked with people like Aretha Franklin. He's done stuff with Fuel, Alice Cooper, Shakira, Julian Lennon, and everybody, when you say it, they know. They know him for GTR.
Yeah.
You know, he's also done stuff for They May Be Giants, Steve Hackett, he's Marillion, you know, we're talking about some prog and stuff, Joe Lynn Turner, Joe Satriani, Saigon Kick, you know, and I said the list goes on and on and on. Now, this is somebody who's raised in Boston, began playing drums at the age of 13. He does rock, soul, R&B, heavy metal, jazz, fusion, funk, punk, rap, hip-hop, pop, pretty much the whole gamut, you know,
pretty
when it's
much.
All said and done. And with that being said, we've got a very fantastic opportunity right here in Radio Memphis to sit down and really kind of crawl into his head. So with no further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let me go ahead and bring on Mr. Jonathan Mover. How are you doing, my friend?
Hello there. I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time with us here on Radio Memphis and Memphis Metal Mondays. I appreciate you so much, sir.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me interest. As far as crawling in my head, I don't know what you're going to find in there, but people can...
You'll be amazed at what I can find.
I'm
one of those, man. It's like, you know, I like to sit with the Pandora's box. Everybody knows that about me, and then that's there, and I start picking the layers off. Now, we you know, actually, what was really cool is that you wound up striking up a relationship with Phil Berger, and he's sitting and guest hosting with me tonight, and he's like my official prog ambassador, you know, from Memphis and stuff, and we're working on a couple of projects together, and you know, he had told me about, you know, reaching out and actually talking with you, and that you yourself are in the middle of some amazing stuff and some amazing projects and things too.
I'm keeping busy. I don't know if it's all amazing, but yeah, I guess so. Yeah,
well, you know, it's funny because when we let everybody know that you were actually going to be talking to us, Jonathan, here on Radio Memphis, the first thing that everybody pops up with is GTR. You know, and I think that's like the synonymous thing that everybody kind of jumps in on you. But, you know, we know that there's so much more, and there's so many other groups and so many other people that you really worked with at a very, very early time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm flattered that, you know, I'm flattered that people know me. I mean, period. But GTR, yeah, I mean, it was a fun gig. It was an eye-opening experience in every way, shape, and form.
Sure.
It didn't last as long as I was hoping or expecting it to.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, they still throw out a live record from here or there, or they remix or remaster. They don't remix. I wish they would, but they remaster over and over, and it gets another little bit of life to it, and everybody, you know, sends an email or you know, remarks about it, but... Yeah, other than that, it's again, it's flattering, but it's hard to believe that it made that much of an impact.
Well, I mean, look, you know, Phil and I have this conversation all the time, and we talk about our music nerds. You know, we're nerds. And
I join your club.
Okay, well then you understand. You know,
totally.
We love it when we can, you know, we can play the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon with who's done stuff with who and who's worked with what, you know, and
well,
that.
I guess I should re-explain.
Okay.
I'm flattered that people connect me to it and they know me from it.
Sure.
I guess what I have to say in all honesty is I'm surprised it made such a splash because, you know, anybody from the prog world, which I guess this is centered on,
yeah,
which
absolutely,
of course, was a big part of my, you know, musical life growing up.
Sure.
Of course, was interested in it because of Howe and Hackett.
Mm-hmm.
But if I was a fan, as I was anyway, but if I was a fan and I wasn't playing in GTR, I think I would have been, you know, no disrespect to myself and everybody else, but I think I would have been quite disappointed like I was when I heard Asia.
What?
Because when I heard Asia,
oh my God,
I was expecting ELP, yes.
Oh,
you know, King Crimson and all of this amazing prog stuff to come out. And instead, we got like a sappy video and heat of the moment. And so, you know, it was kind of the same thing with GTR when we first got together.
Oh, no, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, we were playing some really heavy shit.
No, you're good. You know, this is internet, okay, man. You're good.
I mean, you know, we were playing, you know, lots of tunes in odd time and throwing some real orchestral pieces in and all of that. And that's the direction that we were going in. And in the very beginning, before we actually got the other guys, it was me, Howe, and Hackett first.
Sure.
And we were really throwing all the prog wrenches into the gears, and it was great. But by the time the band really assembled, and we were, you know, for a lack of a better phrase, appointed Jeff Downs to produce us, it really went in the pop direction of let's try to be Asia Junior. Or I should say, let's try to make GTR Asia Junior, which I wasn't really too keen on, but I didn't have much of a choice being 20 years old, and it was my first real big gig. But, you know, when I think of GTR in my heart, I remember the stuff that we did before it got kind of, you know, edited and mutilated and made into a much more palatable, radio-friendly format. But it really had the legs of progressive music when we first got going.
Yes. Now that's, of course, I mean, that you jumping into that, I mean, that's coming on the heels of you coming out of Marillion, right?
Yeah, there was a little bit of space in between, but not much. I had auditioned for Marillion. Well, actually, it's an interesting story. Yeah, I auditioned for a band that you wouldn't call progressive, but it was very progressive, though it was punk. And it was Toya, who was Toya Wilcox, Robert Fripp's wife.
Oh, wow.
And so when I first went over to London, I auditioned for her, which was kind of a progressive punk band. And through that, which was a great audition, and I got on well with everybody, but through that, the bass player recommended me to an engineer named Nick Talber, who was also working with engineering and producing Marillion, and at the same time, they were having drummer problems.
Oh, okay.
So I auditioned for Marillion, and I got the gig. It was a very quick thing. I auditioned on a Wednesday. Thursday evening, I was on a flight to Germany, and Friday night, I was on stage with them
doing
a live record called For Cucumber Lovers or something like that. And, you know, it was a short-lived gig, really, because I ended up not getting along. Actually, I should rephrase that. The lead singer ended up not getting along with me.
Okay.
You know, we were like best friends for a little bit, and then we ended up out in Rockfield Studios, and it's a long story that involves things that we're not going to talk about.
Okay.
But one thing led to another, and being, I guess, 19 years old or so at the time, he had the upper hand and I had the door.
Right.
So when I got released from Marillion, one of the drummers who had also auditioned at the same time that I did, who didn't get the gig, but he obviously made an impression, was Ian Mosley, who was playing with Steve Hackett.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, maybe a month after I left Rockfield, I found out that Ian was the guy they called in. So I called Hackett's manager and said, you know, I was just playing with Marillion. I heard that Ian's playing with them now. You obviously have a vacant drum seat. I would, you know, like to audition. And the guy literally said, I'm so sorry, we just finished auditions, you know, like a week ago after a month, and we had somebody. And so I hung up the phone and figured, okay, you know, bad time, better luck next time.
Wow.
And then about 5 minutes later, I called the manager back, and I said, listen, do me a favor, call Hackett, and please extend this proposition. Tell him to give me an hour in the rehearsal room, and if I get the gig, he pays for the room, and if I don't get the gig, I'll pay for it.
Wow, okay. All right. Now that's kind of cool.
The manager called me back about 10 minutes later and said, quote unquote, Hackett said, you have big balls. See you tomorrow in the rehearsal room.
Of course. Of course. He had to take it.
That was it.
And he had to take it.
And so, so I joined up with Hackett, ready to do a European tour and a record with him.
Sure.
And we were literally like a week or two shy from starting rehearsals when I got the phone call, and he said, you know, I have some good news and bad news, and the bad news is the tour and the record are not happening.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I said to myself, oh, great, you know, I got into Marillion and I was out of Marillion, and now I got in with Hackett and I'm out of Hackett. And
there's a theme.
Okay, what's the good news? And he said, I bumped into Steve Howe, and we're going to do this new supergroup, and we want you to play drums.
Oh, wow.
So So, yeah, it was one of the greatest moments of my life.
That had to have been. I mean, you sit there and you think about it. You know, and you got members of Yes, you know, and all the other groups and stuff that they've been, you know, involved with. And that's obviously had to be some type of a inspiration or an influence on you. And so you're...
Oh, big time.
And you're sitting there going, okay, they like me.
Mm. Yeah, oh, I mean, it wasn't just an influence on me. I knew their music better than they did. You know, we talk about being a geek and that stuff. Yeah. When it came to Yes and Genesis and ELP and Jethro Tull and Gentle Giant and, you know, all of the bands, I was crazy about it and knew everything. So, yeah, it was unbelievable when that happened. I literally, in my head right now, and you're not in there yet, but in my head, I can actually see myself in the rehearsal room with them. And Steve Howe was on my left, and Steve Hackett was on my right. Now, I was in the middle. We were jamming. They were both facing me. And I was basically saying, I can't believe this.
See, Jonathan, and for those of you who are tuned in Memphis Metal Mondays, we are talking to the amazing drummer, producer, you know, extraordinaire, Jonathan Mover. I want to know how you became such a geek. Because, see, here's you started real young, you know, you went to school, okay, you went to college, and you know, and according to the print here, you know, you actually found, you know, you found mentorship, you know, under a particular individual is where you really kind of got started. And so this is one of those things where, you know, what were you looking for when you were doing your music? You decided you wanted to play drums, or you decided you wanted to do music? I mean, where does this start for you? Because we're gonna find your geekdom.
Well, it came in phases, really, and the best way to explain it is I was affected by music very, very early on, like really early on as an infant. And I remember when hearing music, I didn't even want to say listening to music, because I don't know if I was old enough to even, you know, go to a record player and put something on. But
sure.
When I would hear music, I would see pictures. I would get landscapes, and I would get visions. And it was, I still get them today. It's kind of a form of synesthesia. And so music affected me, you know, right away and very heavily from very early on. And then when I started to hear songs and listen to songs that interested me,
sure,
it just, you know, I just gravitated towards it. Now, the first thing that really got me interested in thinking about playing an instrument was hearing the Moog solo at the end of Lucky Man, which was Keith Emerson and the LP.
Right.
And when I heard the sound of a Moog, it flipped me out. And so my first, I guess, direction was, I want to do that. Whatever that is, I want to be able to do that. Wow. And I don't remember how old I was, but I think it was probably, I was maybe 8 or 9. And those records had been out for a few years. I believe the first ELP was 69 or something. And so I was 6 then. So yeah, maybe a couple of years later. Mm-hmm. And so somebody went out and got me. I don't know if it was my parents or maybe my brother or someone had the record in the family, but they had some ELP.
Okay.
And so I started listening to Lucky Man, which flipped me out. And then one thing led to another, and I started hearing the drum solos that Carl Palmer was playing. And that was really my first big hero, was Carl. And that led me to ask my parents to, you know, get me drum lessons when I was maybe 9 or 10 in elementary school.
Oh, my goodness.
And they signed me up, you know, to take lessons in school, which was horrendous. It was, you know, standing up at a snare drum with the drumsticks as thick as baseball bats.
Absolutely.
And playing with, you know, 30 other kids that didn't know what they were doing with their instruments. Not that I did either, but
well,
it
you
was
know.
Just...
I went to band camp.
It didn't sound like what I heard on record. And so I exited from that for a couple of years. And then I got reintroduced to it again when I heard the drum solo from Inagata DeVita. And when I just said, yeah, this is it. I have to play drums.
And so this is one of those things you started really just immersing yourself into all of this. And it was one thing after another, and it was one thing after another. You know, when it's all said and done, you know, the cool thing about you, Jonathan, is that, you know, when you look at all the stuff that your repertoire and all the different people that you've actually played with, along with helped produce and, you know, and record, you've jumped all over the gamut, you know, between, you know, as far as, you know, rock, you know, pop, you know, jazz, fusion, you've you know, prog, you've done it all, you know, and is it just one of those things where, you know, is this a calculated, you know, thing that you do in your head as far as where you're going to go and where you float, or is this where the vision thing comes in and you feel something, you're like, okay, I need to go do that?
It was a combination of things. I mean, number one, I just love playing drums.
Sure.
And I love playing music with people, so I would never want to limit myself, to not be able to play any style of music if I get some enjoyment out of it.
Right.
But when I went to study with Gary Chafee, who is my biggest influence as far as lessons go.
That's the one.
He's got a roster of students, you know, Steve Smith, who went on to play with Journey.
Absolutely.
And Joe Conti and Vinnie Colaiuta, who's the number one drummer in the world, who played the Zappa and Joni Mitchell and Sting and everybody, and Casey Sherrill from Kino Vanelli's band, and a bunch of other guys, J.R. Robinson, one of the biggest, most recorded, you know, pop rock funk drummers in the world. So when I went to Gary, I auditioned to take lessons, and when he, you know, took me on as a student, I basically said to him, I want to make it, and I don't care who I make it with. I know one thing will lead to another. I just want to get my foot in the door. So whatever you need to do to prepare me to play with, whether it's Joni Mitchell or Tito Puente or Motley Crue or mm-hmm. Rita Jingle to do a TV spot, just, mm-hmm. you know, get me there.
Wow.
So although I studied with Gary for a short time, we covered everything, rock, pop, funk, jazz, bop, you know, fusion, polyrhythms, orchestral. We really, you know, did it all. And the other thing is, you know, times have changed and music changes so much.
Sure.
You know, if you, you know, asked me, like, growing up as a kid, with exception to playing for Frank Zappa, which was a dream of mine, you know, what would be the ultimate gig for you? I would probably, off the top of my head right away, say Genesis or Roger Waters.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, so playing that type of material with a band like Genesis really would have been a dream, because you do play everything, and not only is it technical and it's prog and it's odd time and it's fun, it's really phenomenal music.
See.
And for me, that all changed in like the early 80s, the late 70s, and prog then just really lost me. So I wouldn't even say that I would play progressive rock these days, although, you know, to tip his hat there a little bit, the demos that I heard early this morning or yesterday that Phil sent me,
yeah,
some of the best prog that I've heard in a while.
Look
and
at
it's
there.
Not keyboard prog, but it's really nice melodies with interesting odd time. It's
yeah.
not odd time for the sake of throwing in an extra 16th note to throw somebody a curveball. It's odd time because it fits the melody and the phrasing.
Oh, no, that's
and that's
not,
the
yeah.
type of thing that I heard a lot of growing up that interested me that I don't hear anymore.
Yeah, that's how his head works, trust me.
No, it's good. I enjoyed what I heard.
I call it the alphabet. I have ADD and OCD, so I'm all over the place at one time.
Oh, it makes sense. At least it works for you.
No, but you know, Jonathan, I guess, you know, in you just meant, you know, saying what you said, you made one statement that's really sticking in my brain, and so you kind of understand what we do here. Radio Memphis here, you know, we play unsigned and we play indie talent. We do have a concentration of artists, all genres, you know, within, you know, 400 miles of this place, and we play all different kinds of people. And some are that are really, really well known, and some that are just up and coming. I have an Around the World show that I do that's everywhere else, and of course on this show it's Metal Mondays, metal, hard rock, punk, thrash, all of it. We do everything. And one of the things that I always have that I'm always drilling in is, like, I'm always wanting to, you know, give everybody food for thought. And the statement that you made, it's really intriguing me, because you were like, I don't care what I have to do, I just want to make it. I want to know that when you made that statement, what was your definition of making it? Because everybody's is different.
Now, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Because Gary Chafee really straightened my ass out when I said it. Making it, which I said to him, was, you know, if I was only on MTV, had in a band with a gold record and done a world tour, I will have made it. And Gary verbatim looked at me and said, you're going to be all over MTV, have 10 gold records, have 10 tours under your sleeve, and you still won't know if you've really, you know, gotten there yet. And he was absolutely right.
Wow.
But to me, making it, you know, I have to confess, it wasn't about making a living as a drummer. It was about being a rock star.
You said it. Okay, there it is. There it is. Ding, ding, yeah. ding, ding. You admit it. At least you admit it.
Yeah, and And I admit it absolutely, because that's what drove me, you know, to want to attain that and to, you know, to go, you know, level by level and reach more and more. And, you know, there's, I love playing drums, don't get me wrong, and sure. I love the fact that I can, you know, be paid for what I do, and I've made a living never having to do anything outside of music.
Wow.
And it's really great to play in a little club in downtown LA where, you know, the eight drummers in the audience are checking everything out. I do love that, I really do. But there's nothing that compares to doing, you know, an arena or a stadium with Alice Cooper or, you know, Mike Oldfield or any of the other big bands, artists that I've been fortunate to play with, where you look out and see 15, 20, 40,000 people.
Wow.
Man, there's just nothing like it.
And all of a sudden your stomach gets really, really tight and everything starts to tingle and you
look. It's the bomb.
Yeah. All right. Okay. I mean, and I'm totally cool with that, you know, and at least you said it, you know, because everybody, there's a lot of people that are so humble and so cool about it, which I mean, and they're honest, and I get that too, but just to be able to say that you would love to see that or you would love to feel
I'll tell you a quick funny story. When I attended Berklee College of Music, wasn't a great experience for me.
Uh-oh.
I only went for about 3 or 4 weeks, but it's a great school now. It really is. And I don't say that just to make up for what I'm going to say now. But when I went there, my head was in one place and the school was not where my head was at. First of all, I went there to study with Gary Chafee, who had left a couple of years prior, and I didn't know about it. But to cut to the chase, though, I was I didn't know my ass from my elbow when it came to melody or harmony or anything. I could read charts for drums and everything, and I could tinker on a piano and play a bass. But if you threw a piano chart in front of me, I wouldn't know, you know, left from right or whatever.
Wow.
So you had to you know, test to get into different classes.
Yeah, there's
and
a big
so I,
deal.
I tested very high in drumming and rhythm and all of that stuff, but I completely faked my way through the other test that had melody and notation, and for some crazy reason, I ended up in, like, Advanced Harmony 3, and it was totally by, you know, maybe it was multiple choice and I just happened to pick all the right ones.
So you made Christmas trees and it worked.
Yeah. And it didn't do me any favors, believe me, because I had no idea what was going on. But anyway, in one of those classes that I should not have been in, the teacher on the first day said, you know, I want you to stand up and say your name, say your instrument, and tell me why you're going to Berklee.
Okay.
What do you want to do in music? And so, you know, the first kid stands up and says, oh, you know, my name's John Doe. I play guitar and, you know, I would like to, you know, be a teacher. And the second girl stands up and says, I'm Jane Doe and I play piano and I would like to, you know, orchestrate for a symphony. And then, hi, I'm Jonathan Move. I play drums. I want to be a rock star. And the guy looked at me like horns came out of his head and he said, sit down, rock star. And he never answered a question. Now, I could raise my hand for 20 minutes until it was limp and fell down and he would not pay attention to me.
Wow.
So, but from early on, I had no problem saying, that's what I want. And that really is, there's nothing that comes close to it.
And I understand that part. I totally get, but I guess you can kind of understand their point of view too. Is that they wanted to make sure that you were there to learn too, you know? And
I didn't say I wasn't there to learn, but you know, right. He wanted to know what my end result was. You know?
Okay, the and that's an answer.
That's where I'm aiming. Anyway, it didn't go down well, but I hear you.
I'm I'm always on both sides of the fence here, you know, and I'm kind of curious. I'm just kind of curious. That's all.
So no, I get it.
So that little trip didn't work out for you, but you did wind up, you know, catching up, you know, with ultimately who your mentor is, and working with him. Now, what's so amazing and what's so special about Gary? I'm just curious. I love knowing this stuff.
Well, polyrhythms, number one. He's pretty much the master of polyrhythms, and polyrhythms in this day and age are becoming more popular because of, you know, drummers like Vinnie Colaiuta, especially, and myself and Steve Gadd and Simon Phillips, Mike Mangini, and a bunch of guys out there. And polyrhythms basically means multiple rhythms played at the same time.
Yep.
And so Gary was the guy that really broke polyrhythms open. He wrote his own books about them.
Oh, wow.
He was also heavily into linear drumming, which is drumming in line form, meaning that no two limbs line up at the same time.
Right.
And he was just he had his own thing going that Yeah, I can say that probably 95% of all teaching materials out there today are just either a bastardization of something that was there before or something that they took before and then extrapolated on it and maybe changed a few things. But sure. Gary's stuff was completely original, and he really had some amazing concepts, and that was the stuff that interested me. But the bigger picture was he taught Vinnie Colaiuta. Vinnie played the Zappa. Steve Vai also studied some stuff with Gary to learn how to write and understand Polly, but then Vai got the gig with Zappa as a transcriber.
That makes sense.
So I really was also looking, you know, to Gary to be my conduit to get me to Frank. Or I should say to prepare me to audition for Frank.
See, now that makes perfect sense, okay,
yeah.
On that. And so ultimately, you also do what every normal person that's a music nerd that has found their love, you know, and I always tell everybody, you know, as far as the artists and stuff that we try to work with and up and coming and stuff, and everybody's like, well, you know, I love such and such band. And I always tell them, I was like, well, you find out that such and such band, you find out who it is that they love and they followed. And when you find out who they are, find out who that band loved and followed. And when you find out who that is, I want you to keep going until you stop, like, you know, with, you know, rocks and paper and scissors and stuff, you know. Because I want you to come all the way through. And so ultimately, you kind of followed influences to stuff that you were inspired by too.
Yeah, absolutely. And Gary also opened up a lot of those doors too, because aside from progressive, I was definitely into fusion.
Mm-hmm.
But like, for example, you know, Billy Cobham, Tony Williams, you know, two of my favorite drummers that in the early 70s, Cobham with Mahavishnu Orchestra and Tony Williams with Lifetime were mind-blowing. Yeah. I didn't know that, you know, Billy Cobham had come from Horace Silver, and I didn't know that Tony Williams had come from Miles Davis. So Gary also opened up those doors for me to go back. And then, of course, who was Billy into and who was Tony into? You get sent back to Joe Jones, Papa Joe Jones. You get sent back to Sid Catlett and Kenny Clarke and Dave Tuff and, you know, and African music. I'm very, very, very much into African music. The entire continent is just amazing.
Wow.
But my favorite is the music from the Soweto townships of South Africa. So, yeah, thing definitely leads to another, and it's endless. It really is.
See, we can talk about this the whole time. I have this thing, you know, by the way, I have this thing for drummers anyway.
Oh, well, hang on. When am I going to Memphis?
Yeah, I just want to throw that out there, sweetheart, because, you know, like I said, everybody thinks it's always the lead singer, it's the guitar player. Actually, I really have a real big thing for a drummer.
I totally get where you're coming from.
Okay, then do you understand what I'm feeling, and you understand the importance of that, that it's not about the front guy, and it's not about the shredder.
Well, in a joking way, yes, totally, I agree, but in a serious way, too. I mean, if your drummer sucks, then your band is done.
Right! See?
You know,
I love him.
And it doesn't mean that you have to play, you know, circles around everybody, but if you don't keep decent time, have a good feel, and at least give them a foundation to, you know, to play on top of, then forget it.
See?
Hearing you mention Tony Williams, like, I still remember the first time I heard the groove to Fred. And that groove just today, I actually heard a version of Virgil Donati doing that not too long ago with just a bass player. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just even hearing him with his slightly different feel on it was really cool.
Well, the other beautiful thing about Tony is he composed most everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he even did tunes that Miles covered. I mean, you know, he was beyond just a brilliant drummer and a groundbreaker. He was really the total package. Tony's just amazing.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Now Phil being the guitar player, I'm gonna ask Phil this question.
Go ahead.
You know, what is it that you're looking for in a drummer? And I want to see what his answer is.
Drummer has to have groove. I mean, not only just, I mean, groove is such an elusive term in some ways, but it is that pocket. It's that, you know, where you can just fall into it and know that when you're on stage or when you're in the studio, that you can almost fall into that groove and not, you know, even if you get off the rails a little bit, that the drummer is going to keep you locked in.
Yeah.
You know, because I, you know, sometimes, you know, I get lost on stage, man. You know, because I'm pouring.
Okay, so lead guitar player, then it's up to the drummer to keep you in line, which means the drummer's more important, right?
Well, no, I agree. A drummer.
Help me out, Jonathan.
Well, that's what's so unfair about the music world is, you know, when a drummer blows it, but if I'm sitting there, you know, putting the backbeat behind somebody and they're soloing and they go from one mode to the other and they completely lose their time and whatever, they can just say, oh, yeah, man, I'm improvising.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, we definitely take the brunt of all of that stuff. But I do agree that above and beyond all chops, groove, which is a chop in a way, but groove is most important. There's no doubt about it.
Just like when you mentioned Phil Collins.
When you listen to somebody like John Bonham, you know, playing the groove on The Crunge.
Sure.
I mean, that is sickeningly good. That is beyond brilliant.
Yes.
And what, aside from his feel, which is gorgeous, and his chops, which are insane, the fact that he plays a track in 9/8 that the average layman listener would never know is on time and they could dance to, that says more than anybody could ever play in one of these new bands that can play in 1916.
Sure.
See?
Definitely.
There it is.
And that's what makes, to me, that's what made Phil Collins. Because Phil Collins could take any of the weird stuff.
Oh, here it goes. Here it goes. Well, I mean, he mentioned Genesis earlier, so our
I know.
The world stopped.
I'm a Genesis nerd. And
yeah. I mean, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, I was into all of the prog. Phil Collins, it's a funny story. When I got into GTR, I was over the moon. I mean, as you can possibly imagine, it was the biggest dream come true ever. There were only two things missing in GTR.
Yeah.
Phil and Bill. Phil Collins wasn't there and Bill Bruford wasn't there. And it was really crazy because, you know, here I am, 19 or 20 years old, and I, for the 6 years or 7 years prior to me getting over there, I spent countless hours in my basement practicing for Genesis and Yes and Crimson and everything. And it was, I never realized that a big part of me practicing and playing along to those records was me pretending that I was sitting next to Bill or Phil, not replacing them.
Wow.
So, you know, when I got the gig with Howlin' Hackett, it was amazing. And it was so, you know, it was an extraordinary situation for me. But it was a huge disappointment that I wasn't hanging with Phil Collins and Bill Bruford. And those two guys from the prog world are really two of my gods of Mount Olympus.
Both of them,
you know, they're just amazing, both of those guys. But Phil Collins, yes, he really is. You know, one of my, in counting on one hand, he's definitely in that one hand. He's the man.
He's the deal.
He really is.
The man has a feel like very few people, and he's got chops like very few people.
All you gotta think is that groove in the cage off of Lamb Lies Down on Broadway.
Even more than that is the Colony of Slippermen.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that groove, which is a halftime shuffle years before Bernard Purdy and everybody else. I mean, you know, and it's an odd time. I mean, the whole Lamb record is, listen, you got to call me back for a week on Phil Collins.
I said before you called in.
You talk about a geek. He's one of the guys that I really do know everything about. And yes, I agree with you about In the Cage. You know, back in New York City, all the way right through, you know, Duke and Abacab, and then there were three. I mean, Phil is just a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but, you know, it's not a pity that people know him as a lead singer and a piano and a pop star and, you know, worth $100 million because he's all over, you know, the pop world.
Sure.
That's wonderful for him, and it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. But it's just a shame that people don't know the background of what he did. You know, even the stuff that he's done with other people, you know, the stuff that he did with Peter Gabriel, the stuff that he did with Eric Clapton, Brian Eno, Brand X. I mean, you know, as a session guy also.
Well, Brand X is going back out on tour, but not with Phil, I don't think.
Sorry, what is it?
Brand X is actually on tour, or they went on tour earlier this year.
They went back out with...
Was it just another
drummer who actually did study with Gary Chafee, and he was on the Livestock record, the live one. I'm totally spacing. No, I'm not. Kenward Dinard.
Gotcha.
Yeah, Kenward did the run, and I think it was just Kenward and it was
John Goodzill.
John was back with Percy?
I'm pretty sure, because a good friend of mine down in Texas is good friends with John Goodzill, and I'm pretty sure they were talking about that, you know, because they were going to be in Nashville, and I know I missed the show, but
because the two of them were absolutely, you know, oil and water, and with flames in there. But if you have a minute for a funny one,
we got a minute for you, man.
Okay, so
I got a thing for drummers.
I'm in New York City. I live in LA now, but when I was living in New York for 27 years. For about 17 years, I owned one of New York's, I don't want to say biggest, but one of New York's best state-of-the-art recording studios called Skyline.
Okay, yes, we knew about that.
We had from David Bowie to Steely Dan, Mariah Carey, everybody recorded there. And so one day, we get a booking, and it's for Percy Jones, who, of course, you know, I'm a huge Brand X nut, or actually everything with Phil Collins, I'm a nut.
You're just a nut for
the records that Phil was playing with Brand X, I was all over it. And so he's coming into Skyline to do a teaching video for bass, instructional video. And anyway, without getting into too many details, it was a Saturday morning that they were recording. And I went in Friday night because I knew the drummer. And I set up the drums and I got everything ready for them. And then I went out on a little pub crawl with two of my friends from Australia that I hadn't seen for a while.
Okay.
And although I do love beer very much and Guinness, I'm not a heavy drinker, and it doesn't take much to get me whacked.
Nice.
And so we started at about 8 o'clock, and I crawled into my house with the two of them, and I mean crawled, not because we were tired, at about 4 o'clock in the morning. I was absolutely smashed. So I finally fell asleep, and my phone rings at about 7 a.m., and I wake up, and I'm pickled. I've actually been, like, you know, fermenting in my sleep.
You don't even know what you did.
I don't know what city I'm in. And the guy on the phone is the manager of Percy Jones, and says, we have a problem with the drummer. Is it possible that you can go in and play on this thing today? And, of course, I wasn't going to miss my chance to play with Percy Jones.
No, of course not.
Even though I'm drunk as skunked. So I jump out of bed, take a cold shower, drink as much coffee and water as I can, and I run up to the studio, and my head is pounding, and my skin is like gray leather. It was not a good day. Anyway, Percy comes in, and right away, very nice, very courteous, and thanks me for subbing, and I looked at him, and I said, no problem, this is such a pleasure and an honor. I know every Brand X tune by like the back of my hand. Just let me know what you want to play and we'll knock it out.
Wow.
And just like the teacher at Berkeley, horns sprouted from his head, and he looked at me and said, I don't play Brand X. So they threw this material at me, which, again, no disrespect to him, because he's an unbelievable bass player. I mean, Jesus, unbelievable. But the material that he was working with in a band called Tunnels was prog for the sake of being prog. It made no sense to me. It was an odd measure, every other measure of a different time signature, but not for any melodic reasons. And this is just my opinion.
Okay.
So it was not an easy thing to digest being as hungover and drunk as I was, but
nice.
Anyway, I got through it, and that's my Percy Jones story.
Wow. Well,
you know, I can't imagine what he thinks of me these days, but the video did come out, and there you go.
You know, it's funny. It's funny for those of you that are tuned in. You tune in to Memphis Metal Mondays, and we're actually sitting down, and we're on a phone interview, and we're talking to Jonathan Mover, and I have to sit there, and I'm digesting all of this stuff, and even some of the stuff that I've actually come across. You know, when I was trying to learn about all the things that you've stepped into, and you know, most people they see what you do now, and you know, they see your resume, they see that you've worked with all these incredible people, and they look like it. Okay, it's like an overnight success, and just because you knew so and so, therefore your career was made, and I always try to connect the dots on how that's not the case. You know, you actually had to do some like really crazy stuff, you know.
It certainly wasn't overnight in the sense that I paid a lot of dues in practice and time put into and energy put into, you know, facilitating myself and getting prepared for making the bigger move to London.
Right.
But it came pretty quick. I have to be honest about that.
Okay.
But on the other hand, you know, it's a 35-plus year career on a roller coaster.
Nice.
And that's the truth. I mean, there are some years that, man, you know, you hear yourself on the radio on three or four different records, and you know, you do an amazing tour, and then there are some years where you played on seven indie CDs that have never seen the light of day.
Right.
And, you know, you did nothing that doesn't measure up, because some of the best records I've played on, nobody's ever heard. And some of the best tours I've done have been small club tours. But I guess the honest way to answer this is, you know, some years bring in $300,000 or $400,000, and some years bring in $80,000 to $100,000. And although 80 to 100 might still sound amazing to some people, and it is to me, there's a big difference between the two.
There is.
You have to learn how to kind of weather the storms and balance yourself out. So when it's raining and pouring, you know, you've got buckets out there, you know, picking up all the extra water. And when it's dry, like the desert, you know, you've got some supplies to get you through. So it's no walk in the park. But it's a blast. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
See, that's the perfect answer. So when you got done, I mean, as far as studying with Gary and stuff, now was going to London, was that always a plan for you, or is that something you just fell into?
It was kind of a plan because of my love of progressive rock music, and most of it being from England.
Oh, okay.
You know, with exception to Zappa, the Tubes, Todd Rundgren and Utopia, or maybe a few lesser known fusion-y prog bands, everything to me came out of England that interested me.
But I guess
the turning point or the bridge was, I knew that I was going to have to leave Peabody, Massachusetts, because I wasn't the type of person that was playing in local bands and hoping, like, you know, the new Aerosmith or the new Cars were going to form and I was going to be a part of it. I just didn't imagine that happening to me. So I knew I was going to have to move, and I knew it was probably going to be New York or L.A. if I stayed in America, which at that time I was intending, or possibly London.
I got you.
And my favorite drummer at the time, who I go through different favorite drummers, but
okay,
one of my favorites of all time, who was my favorite and probably my biggest overall influence, who's now a dear friend of mine, is a guy named Simon Phillips.
Yes.
And so when Simon was coming to America for his first clinic tour, the short story is, I went to the clinic and ended up meeting him before he played, and we hung out for a while, and I had, talk about a geek, I had more records than he played on than he knew about.
Oh.
And when it came time for him to do a website with his discography, he actually called me and said, can you please, you know, fill in the blanks. But anyway, when I showed up with a list and a notepad of every record that I had of his, and said to him, you know, is there anything you've done recently that I wouldn't know about that I can check out? And he said, oh, yeah, you know, I did this, and I played with this band called Toya.
Wow.
And so I went out and I bought the Toya records, which were not available in America. I ordered them from my local import store in Saugus, Massachusetts, called Rocket Records.
Oh,
and
how
about
cool.
A month later, these two records showed up, and I put the live one on, and it just blew my mind.
Oh,
now,
no.
I guess this was 1981 or 2.
Okay.
And now, mind you, this was also at a time without the internet where you could, you know, you could do things then that you can't do now. And
right.
I picked up the phone and I called EG Records in New York, and I said, I would like to get in touch with the management for Toya Wilcox, who's on your label.
Right.
They gave me the number to EG Records in London. So the next day I called London from Peabody, Massachusetts. I'm a teenager. And I said, I'd like to get in touch with the management for Toya Wilcox. Can you tell me, you know, who it is and blah, blah, blah. And they gave me the number to a woman named Corinne Osborne. And see, this is all in my head. That's why there's no room for you.
I know. I see. My God, I understand that if we ever really had to share some space, that would be not possible, and I have to bring my own blanket.
I could really use a break and hear it out. But anyway, so I called the next day, and I said, hey, I'm a friend of Simon Phillips. I'm a professional drummer, which I wasn't. And I wasn't a friend of Simon's. I met him for one day. Well, I guess I was a professional, but not in the sense of what they were looking for. And I said, I'm going to be in London, you know, sometime in the next couple of months to do a few sessions that I've been booked on. And I know that Simon's not playing with Toya anymore because he just told me, is there a vacancy? And I'd be into it.
Right.
And she said, actually, we don't have anything going right now because the band just came off of tour with Simon, but call us when you're over here and we'll see what happens.
Okay.
And so, you know, just like that, I bought a ticket maybe a month later, and I called them up when I got over there. Within a couple of days, I was auditioning for them.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, really, you could literally call a record label, and they would give you this information. And that really was the end for me. So it was the love of English progressive rock with meeting Simon Phillips and him telling me about Toya and me just being so enamored with it, to me hopping on a plane. And I got to tell you, and this is no joke, the moment that the plane touched down and the wheels hit the tarmac at Heathrow, I knew I was home.
You knew you were home. You knew something had clicked, and you knew that's where you belonged.
Yeah, and I stayed for about 8.5 or 9 years.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
I miss it like crazy.
Do you really? Do you ever find like do you ever think you're going to go back?
I do. I mean, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, which was the end of the run that I wanted to do with my studio in New York. You know, I was in a long-term relationship. I was living in New York, had a great penthouse. Life is wonderful. Got my big studio. And my landlord came in one day and handed me a new lease, and he said, you know, your lease is up in a few months, and here's another 10 years. And I was already into my second 10-year lease.
Wow.
And I said, great. And I walked home, and when I was walking home, something clicked. And I said, you know, this is not what I want to do. I need to take a break, and I need to think about what's going to be next, you know, in music and drums.
Sure.
And I gave him the lease, and I said, I'm not taking it. You know, here it is unsigned. I'll be out in 3 months. I broke up with the girl.
Put
my apartment on the market. and I was literally thinking about moving back to London. And that's when I ended up getting called to go back on the road with Alice Cooper.
Okay.
Who I'd had a relationship with since 1989.
Wow.
And during that tour, the bass player and I got along really well, and the rhythm guitar player, who is kind of like the musical director and one of Alice's co-producers, he and I really hit it off. And so the bass player was doing his own record with a band called Bisto Blanco in L.A. after we finished the tour, and he asked me to play on it, and Tommy Hendrickson was producing it, the guitar player. So I flew out to L.A. We knocked it out up in Burbank. And while I was out here in L.A., a very good friend of mine told me I should call this guy. He's a good friend of his. He's got a rehearsal studio in L.A., and he's looking to expand rehearsals into recording and all sorts of big things. And I know you've got $500,000 of gear in storage after you close Skyline, so maybe you guys should meet.
Sure.
So I called him up. We met. We got together. I was not expecting it, but one thing led to another, and instead of him possibly buying all of my gear, I ended up moving out to L.A. and merging with him, and we now have this massive facility out here in L.A. that's absolutely kicking ass, and it's a lot of work, but it's going really, really well, and so London is still maybe in the future, but right now, for at least a decade, I'll be out here on the West Coast.
Right. Now taking Skyline Studios and stuff, now, you wound up moving it out to L.A., and what did you wind up actually merging with?
Swing House, actually.
Yeah.
And so I dropped the name Skyline. It's now Swing House. But it's the old Swing House was just kind of a, you know, a bohemian, is the nice way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, little place in Hollywood.
Sure.
But the place that we have now is 23,000 square feet in Atwater Village in a beautiful brand new warehouse that we built up from scratch.
Wow.
And, you know, we've got a gorgeous studio bigger than Skyline. We're still building it out, but we've got 4 sound stages that are massive. Everybody from Dr. Dre and Seal to Moby and Aerosmith, and you know, Alice Cooper's been in with Joe Perry, so
wow.
You know, we can have the smallest local band to the biggest, you know, tours in the world rehearsing and doing production with us. We've got producer suites that are all state of the art. We have a backline rental company. We do offsite event production and management. So it's a big undertaking, but it's really going well.
And you know, it's funny because you even bring that up is because I was actually doing some research and stuff, and I understood about the deal with Swing House, and I thought it was kind of cool on, you know, some of the programs and some of the stuff that was coming through. I did not realize that you were in the middle of it, my dear.
Yeah. In the middle, on top, underneath, on the side.
Every which way but loose.
Well, yeah, it's a big deal, but, you know, I've never been one to be, you know, to sit in the background and to take time off. You know, even I would come back from 8 months on tour and one day home was enough for me to relax and catch up. Sure. I don't sit back and I don't relax much. So, you know, it was the obvious thing for me to jump into. It was exciting and it was new and fresh. And I'd been commuting to L.A. for many, many years, but I'd never spent more than 10 days out here.
I got you.
And so this was a new venture and very exciting. And, you know, there was a whole new group of people to meet, new musicians to play with, and a new atmosphere and everything. So I'm enjoying it. I'm glad it's happening.
There's always got to be, look... All right, now that we've kind of gone over some of the stuff, and I know we've not even scratched the surface with you, and I get that, but it's some of the stuff that you've actually jumped into, you know, Jonathan, and the people that you worked with, the fact that you've been on tour, the fact that you've had your own recording studios and whatnot, there's got to be some kind of little yearning, in, you know, that likes to know that you want to find the next big somebody, or you want to be able to know that you caught lightning in a bottle, you know, and it sounds like with the deal with Swing House that you guys have actually put together this environment that not only, you know, accommodates, you know, the national acts and stuff like that to be able to come and perform and have a good time. It also accommodates, you know, for locals, unsigns and things like that to have a place to perform, actually get some insight, actually get some recordings done, actually get some teams and stuff to work with them. There's a very specific process that's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's two sides to it. One side is it puts me in the middle of everything that you just said, which is really great.
Yes.
And for example, I played on a record for a brilliant young guitar player, singer who's coming up called Jared James Nichols.
Okay.
Eddie Kramer produced it, and he's been on the road for the last year with his trio, playing with Zach Wilde and Lynyrd Skynyrd and Glenn Hughes. And he's just tearing it up. He's in the magazines. He's got unbelievable amounts of hits and likes and, you know, whatever you do on the internet to say that you're into somebody. And so I never would have probably come across a gig like that and quite a few other sessions here in L.A. if I wasn't out here and if I wasn't, you know, in the midst of Swing House.
I got you.
But it also still, you know, affords me the opportunity to put together my own things or, you know, do something on the side. And there's a couple of projects that I am starting to kind of mold the clay into that I'm very excited about. And, I think one of them, you know, certainly has the potential to be huge, and the other one has the potential to be really just amazing music with great players.
Okay.
So as long as I have, you know, the opportunities to do that. Now,
he's just going to leave us hanging. You're not even going to tell us what it is. I caught that.
Well, Not yet.
Okay, all right.
Some of the people involved aren't ready to announce whatever, but
right.
You'll find out about it. But, I kind of had the same opportunity in Skyline, but in Skyline I was the sole owner, and so I didn't have as much opportunity, even though I played on so many records through Skyline because it was part of the daily job in there. I didn't really have the, you know, Skyline was a little bit of a ball and chain because... I wouldn't have been able to go out and do, say, a 4, 6, or a 10-month tour with somebody like I used to do before I took Skyline.
I got you.
Because no matter who I put in charge, it just never did as well. You know, I would leave for 3 weeks with the Tubes because I toured with them off and on. And, you know, I would get back and things would be okay, but bookings would have, you know, slid down a little bit and a few things broke and they didn't fix them. And, you know, so I'm hoping that in Swing House, even though I'm a big part of it, there are two other people around me in the daily business that are working with me, that I'm working with them, and we're handling everything together. So that if an artist comes to me like Alice, and, you know, I couldn't have toured with Alice if I hadn't just closed Skyline. And that's the reality and the sad reality. It was great timing. But, you know, had I still had the studio going and they called me up and said, you know, they called me on a Wednesday and said, we need you on stage Friday, I would have been like, oh man, you know what? I can do a few gigs and help you out, but you're going to have to find somebody that can leave, you know, home.
Right, right.
And so I don't ever want to be in that position again. It was great for the 17 years that I was in there, and I got to play on a bunch of records that I never would have played on just because of being there when they were happening.
Sure.
But I don't ever want to be able, I don't ever want to be in a position where I have to say no to something that I would really want to do.
And
that happened, you know, a good too many times with Skyline.
I got you.
I think Swing House is the right situation. And these other two projects I'm talking about, I'll be able to do them, one or both of them, and not lose any traction with what's going on business-wise.
I got you. Well, you know, and it sounds like it was an amazing decision for you. The other thing, I'm listening to all of this, you know, Jonathan, and those of you who are tuned in to Metal Mondays talking to Jonathan Mover.
Now, I must say, it's funny to hear you call me Jonathan. I don't mind it, but everybody in the world calls me Mover.
I know.
Except for my mother and a girlfriend. I have one.
I know. But see.
But, you know, it's funny to hear Jonathan. It's nice. I just haven't heard it in a long time.
Oh,
please
see.
Please continue, Diana.
See, and I've never, normally they call me Dirty D and stuff, so for somebody to call me Diana, it's like, I feel like we're developing this relationship, like, on air, and sharing it with everybody that's listening.
And millions of people are witnessing.
Absolutely.
You know, there's history in the making.
And there is history in the making, and you just made me completely forget my question. I'm kidding.
She's all flustered.
I know. And you do, have you noticed, like, I know you noticed a little red in my cheeks and stuff? Actually, no, I didn't forget. I'm trying to figure out how, okay, you've got all of this, and what's amazing is that you also juggle a very incredible magazine too.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Drumhead Magazine.
Yeah, you know, and the funny thing, the first thing I can say when somebody says, you know, you have this magazine, you know, why? How? What happened? You know,
because you're a geek.
I never wanted to own a recording studio. Trust me. It was something that fell in my lap and was presented to me. I knew nothing about it. I'd done a little bit of engineering and producing, but not to the extent of, you know, massive like that. And I said, yeah, sure, you know, I'll give it a shot. And 17 years later, there you go. It was the same thing with the magazine. Never in my life would I have ever dreamed of owning my own or doing a magazine, a drum magazine. But I had somebody approach me about 11 years ago, which was a European music publisher. And he wanted to break into the States. And he thought the best way to break into the States would be to start with a drum magazine and then branch out into guitar and vocals and everything else like he does in Germany.
I got you.
And so I met him in a funny way through my little brother. And when he approached me, he basically said, this is what I want to do. And, you know, I've looked you up. I know all about you. Would you be interested in being the editor-in-chief and, you know, maybe having a piece of it? And I said, no, thank you very much. I would be a creative consultant or a design, you know, artistic designer for you as far as the conception goes. But I don't know anything about editing a magazine. I read books, and that's about the extent of it. So, you know, find somebody and then give me a call, and I'll help you with the creativity side of it.
Sure.
And so he spent about 3 or 4 months interviewing editors from all different magazines and publications, and he kept on calling me back saying, I don't think they have the passion and the knowledge that you have.
Oh.
And so I basically said, okay, fly me to Germany. Let me spend a week in your facility. I want to go from department to department, from the first to the last, in 1 week to see how you put out a magazine.
That's
show me the, you know, show me the content, the editorial, the photos, the layout, the design, you know, the packaging. Just tell me what they do.
Right.
Let me see it. And at the end of the week, I'll either find somebody to do it for you or I'll do it myself. And so we spent a great week over there. And at the end of the week, I looked at him and I said, I can do this for you. I'll give it a shot.
Sure.
And so, you know, we went into business, and I'm extremely grateful because it was his money that started the magazine. There's no doubt about it. Never would have happened without, you know, a massive amount of money.
Sure.
But it got to the point where, business-wise, between a few different people, it just wasn't working out. And all I can say is I ended up the sole owner of it. It's extremely profitable now, and it's the number one drum magazine in circulation.
It is.
I took it over.
Congratulations.
That one I will tip my hat to. My drumming, forget it. I don't know really what I'm talking about, but as far as knocking this magazine out, I really do think it's a great piece of paper, and I'm really happy with with, you know, everybody that loves it and all the emails that I get and the people that, you know, that get something from it. That means a lot to me.
That's fantastic stuff. Mm. That's amazing stuff right there.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I could sit here and talk to him all night.
Yeah.
But at some point, I have to start playing some music. I'm sorry. I was like, man, I can just hang out. We have to do this again.
Well, it'd be my pleasure.
We'd have to do this again. There's definitely so much stuff that we've got coming up, you know, between me and Phil and stuff. I mean, what do you think, Phil?
I think definitely that would be, like I said earlier before you called in, I said if we covered everything you did for 5 minutes, we'd probably be here for the next month.
Mm-hmm. And he was right.
Thank you.
He was right. I mean, I'm sitting here trying to dive into it, man. It's like I just got in the front door. I didn't even dove into anything yet.
I mean, we glanced over all the projects you do, and then, you know, like I said to you before, you know, my first experience was with hearing you with Einstein opening up for Dream Theater, and you know, I bought the first CD at the show. Didn't even know there was a second CD out, and just, it was an awesome show. It was a great double bill in a small club before Dream Theater was really, I mean, they were known, but they weren't, you know, the band that they are today. And
right,
you know, it was awesome seeing, you know, I mean, Mulcahy's, you know, in New York is not that big of a club, and you know, it was nice. I mean, I remember it was right around the holidays, so driving back to Pennsylvania, where I'm from, was an interesting trip.
No, cool. Yeah, I mean, that was fun. That was an interesting project for me. It was really me stepping out of my comfort zone and getting into writing and composing, doing most of the music on both of the records and taking a stab at some lyrics. So it was eye-opening in every way, shape, and form, and it was a lot of fun doing it.
That's amazing stuff. Yeah. So, Jonathan, I have to ask you a question.
Sure.
If you got the opportunity now, and this is ultimately what I always try to, you know, get back to a lot of the listeners. Well, for us here at Radio Memphis, we have a ton of listeners, but we're also one of those like musician websites, you know, and musician radio stations where a lot of, you know, musicians support each other and they like to tune in and stuff. And so they're always looking for food for thought. You've got the guys that come in that are just getting started. You've got the ones that have just started following their mentors, and you've got the ones that have marched into the room and said, I want to do whatever it takes to just make it. and they've come to you and they ask you those same questions on what they have to do. What are you telling them?
Well, I mean, there's a general broad scope of what you would tell somebody, and then obviously there's more defined things that you would speak to somebody about depending on their personality and you know, what you feel, you know, they can or maybe cannot do.
Sure.
I mean, I think that everybody has a chance and everybody has an opportunity.
Okay.
And I don't think that you should ever let anybody tell you that you don't. Now, you know, there's a good thing about that, which is there's great music and there's great players and the cream usually does rise to the top.
Yeah.
The bad thing about it is with Pro Tools, we can make shit really good tasting cream these days.
Right.
And so, you know, you really can tell somebody. So you could think to yourself, like, this person is never going to get anywhere, right. And the next thing you know, they're on a demo that just sounds amazing. So I think there's a lot of avenues out there, and anybody that wants to go down any or all of them should do that. I would just say two things, and this is, you know, one of them is don't expect it to be a very long career. Because in this day and age, it's not what it was like growing up listening to Genesis and Yes and Zeppelin, where you had, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of records and an audience that bought all of them.
Wow.
I mean, I even own Tomato.
Wow. See?
You know,
I like Tomato.
I was into Yes because that was the record that everybody fell off with. But so, you know, I mean, a lot of the bands out there today and a lot of the artists out there today, they can get their foot in the door and they can get somewhere, but it usually doesn't last as long as it did, you know, when I was listening to bands as a kid and even fortunately lucky enough to start my career in the early 80s.
Sure.
Because you could get a really long one. And the other thing that I would say, which is going to sound, you know, maybe a little bit pretentious and a little, or maybe prophetic to some and silly to others, but it really is the thing that drives me. Just be honest.
There it is.
You know, I mean, that's the reason why my studio in New York did so well when every other studio closed. And that's the reason why my magazine has turned into number one because of my interviews. And that's the reason why Swing House is doing great, because we don't lie, we don't cheat, we don't steal from people.
Love it.
You know,
love it.
We really try to just be honest. So be honest with yourself and what you want out of life, and be honest with the people around you. And, you know, it might not work all the time because it's a dishonest world.
Yeah.
But when it does work, it really does work for the right reasons. And that's just what I live by. I think it's great, but most people really can't do that.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite piece of advice I've gotten on here. I love it. Thank you so much, my dear. You are
my pleasure. Again,
you are
I'm
awesome.
Flattered that you're even interested, so I really appreciate your time and having me on here.
Oh, I have a feeling that we're all going to keep in touch, and I have a feeling that, you know, that our paths are going to cross again. I want you.
Well, hearing Phil's music yesterday, I have a feeling we will keep in touch. And,
good.
And awesome. I think I'll be coming through Memphis probably sometime soon.
You need to, and I tell you, if there's anything that we can do for you here, you know, at Radio Memphis and stuff, you let me know. And of course, you've got Phil. I think what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to go out on this interview. I'm going to play one of your songs through GTR. I'm going to play. I'm going to play Imagining. For some reason, it just kind of made sense.
Oh, well, that's very nice. Thank you. That was the one that I co-wrote for the record. Or actually, I should say, in all honesty, Phil Spaulding, the bass player, and I co-wrote quite a bit of the record. But all of us being a lot younger and a lot greener than Mr. Howe and Mr. Hackett, we were basically afforded the opportunity to have publishing on the one song we had the most influence on, which I was grateful for, and Imagining was pretty much my tune.
That is fantastic.
Awesome.
See, I love knowing that. That's a good deal. Mm. Well, darling, yep. I know you've had a long day. I know you've been in the studio and you've been rocking out and doing your stuff. So I want you to go and relax and, you know, take care of yourself. You'll be hearing from us very, very soon. And if you need...
I look forward to it.
Yeah, if you need anything from us here at Radio Memphis, you let me know, okay?
I certainly will. Likewise.
All right. Thanks
All right.
again.
Thanks, man. Appreciate you.
My pleasure. Have a nice evening.
You too. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Ciao.
What do you think?
He's awesome. He's awesome.
He's cool.
Yeah.
He's cool.
Very cool guy. And like, you know, since we started talking about the interview, has been nothing but accommodating. You know, I think last night I had about 6 or 7 emails come through with different tracks and different things that, you know, he wanted us to cover. And
you know what's new? You can see in my head, right? It's like, yeah. Okay, you know, I'm like a cat with the little toy. And it was like, I didn't get to rip it open.
Yeah, it's... Well, I mean, there's so much.
There's
a ton.
Oh my God.
We glanced over things, and when you have someone like that, or like we did last week with Randy George, where these guys have so much to offer, and they're, you know, even though are they the names you read every time you pick up a magazine or every time you pick up a, you know, open up a website? Maybe not.
Right.
But are they guys that you know? That are in the know and have, I mean, how many people can say that their first major gig when they were 20 years old was with Steve Hackett and Steve Howe?
And there's not that many that can say that.
I mean, I think we just talked to the one that can.
Yeah, and that's really cool. Beautiful thing though is that, I mean, as cool as he was about it, and he was very honest.
He was.
He did give the honest statement, but you know, he also. Which he did. He kind of shied away from, and I don't want to use that word. You know, it's not that he shied away from, but he really had the influence of, yeah, I want to be a rock star.
Yeah.
But he was doing everything he needed to do,
yeah,
in order to learn and in order to grow and in order to follow the right people and work with the right groups.
I'm gonna sum it up in a weird way, but it's
okay.
Gonna make sense.
All right.
While his answer was, I want to be a rock star.
Hmm.
But the hunger and the drive that he had was well beyond what most people think of. It wasn't somebody walking around flipping their hair around because they think they're a rock star, or dressing the part and wearing a leather wristband because that's the style. But
he did all that, right? So
I'm sure he did.
Well, you showed me the picture, man. It was really pretty hair, too.
Jonathan, that was D. That was not Phil.
I'm just,
just remember
I'm
that.
I was just throwing that out there, man. Just
and,
you know.
But I mean, you know, but there was a love of music there.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't just somebody doing it because, well, you know what? It's cool. I'm going to get chicks. I'm going to do this. You know. And that was the time frame where that's why you did it.
Mm.
You didn't do it because, you know, you had this great love of music. You did it because, hey, you know, the guys in Poison are, you know, they look like chicks, but they're getting all the chicks, you know, and, you know, and so here's a guy who really was hungry and he really pursued what he loved and what he wanted. And, you know, like you said, you know, he was, you know, you can't deny the fact that the bottom line is you got to be honest about what you want.
Yep.
You got to be honest with other people because in this world, that's all you got, you know, especially in the music industry where, you know, every other person you run into will try to, you know, stab you in the back and run away with your...
Yeah, but that's all, you know, that's all negative stuff. That's all negative stuff.
And, but, you know, someone like that, hearing just everything you talked about and with everything that's going on at Swing House, you know, musicians in the LA area, you need to check it out because...
And if you have that opportunity, are you kidding? Yeah, man, they've got all kinds of cool stuff going on over there.
And I mean, and you know, you can look up all the recordings that he's been involved in, you know, from a production standpoint as well. I think it's all, I think the discography's all on his website. And it delineates whether it was something that he was drumming on, something he was co-writing, something he was producing.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, because the list goes on. I mean, even if we just read the list, we'd probably be another 20 minutes of reading.
It would take forever, and we can't do that, because you know what we have to do?
We've got to play a song.
Man, we got to play a song, man. We had him on the phone for over an hour. I could have talked to him for the entire show.
Yeah. It's nice to see the humility in someone who's been everything he has been and everything he continues to still be.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what you come across. Mm. The bigger names you talk to, the majority of the time, the more humble and the more... caring about the upcoming they are.
Well, we'll see what happens with this one.
Definitely.
In the meantime, a lot of these people know him from this one particular band.
Some GTR.
Yeah, I gotta play some GTR. So we're gonna play some Imagining right here on Radio Memphis and Memphis Metal Mondays. And this one is for Mr. Jonathan Boover, because I say his whole name. Right here on Radio Memphis.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated and originally aired live on Radio Memphis. Any offers or advertisement contained may not still be valid. All rights are reserved and copyright is held by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more, look for all the RMOD players at radio-memphis.com.